From Pennsylvania to Arizona, Nebraska to South Carolina, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, soft on crime district attorneys have unleashed a crime wave in cities across the nation. For a look at how this happened, we talk with Zach Smith, author of the book Rogue Prosecutors, How Radical Soros Lawyers Are Destroying America's Communities. Control of the U.S. Senate will once again be up for grabs in 2026. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth joins us with the real story on key races across the nation. Make America healthy again is a noble goal, but could government go too far? Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine is joined by Jeff Singer of the Cato Institute. And taxes are a fact of life. Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council offers his 10 Golden Rules of Taxation on this week's American Radio Journal Commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Cities from sea to shining sea have elected progressive district attorneys only to be hit with a crime wave. For a look into the situation, we turn to Zach Smith. He is senior legal fellow and manager of the Supreme Court and Appellate Advocacy Program at the Heritage Foundation and co-author of the book Rogue Prosecutors, How Radical Soros Lawyers Are Destroying America's Communities. Zach, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Zach, before we get into some of the individual prosecutors who are rogue prosecutors, as your book title would indicate, tell us a little bit about how this sort of subspecies, if you will, of prosecutors even came into existence.
It's really mind-boggling when you look at it, Loman. I am a former federal prosecutor, former assistant United States attorney, and so when I first heard there was this group of prosecutors that was refusing to prosecute entire categories of crimes, that were refusing to seek appropriate penalties in all cases, I couldn't believe it. But the more I dug, the more I found, and the more it became apparent that this, of course, was a national movement that was pushing a very radical view of what it means to be a prosecutor, and in fact, a view of a prosecutor that did not prosecute many, many crimes. And so what I found is that the kind of the origin of this entire movement started with something called the prison abolition movement. This was a radical movement started in Berkeley, California by radical academics, Angela Davis. Some of your listeners may know that name, among others. They actually believed that essentially no one should go to prison for any reason and that we should abolish all prisons here in the United States. Now, you can imagine that did not get a very warm reception from elected officials or the public. And so what happened, if we fast forward several decades, is that instead of explicitly pushing this prison abolition movement, what Angela Davis and others who supported that movement found is that if you change who enforces the laws, the prosecutor, you don't have to do that very difficult, very tough work of getting the laws on the books changed. And unfortunately, what this group pushing this radical rogue prosecutor movement realized is that the local elected district attorney is the linchpin to our criminal justice system. It doesn't matter how many arrests police make if the prosecutor won't prosecute the offenders. And likewise, it doesn't matter how good your judges are. It doesn't matter how good the laws on the books are. It doesn't matter what types of decisions a jury would make, because none of those actors will ever see a case or see a criminal defendant if, again, the prosecutor refuses to prosecute crimes. And unfortunately, wherever these rogue prosecutors have been elected, crime and chaos and misery have followed in their wake.
And of course, to elect these rogue prosecutors, there has been a national movement that has been well funded. Tell us a little bit about how this funding for these campaigns has come about.
Yeah, well, obviously, I don't think the title of my book hides the ball. George Soros has been one of the major funders of this movement. He's given direct campaign contributions. We estimate somewhere north of $40 million, and that's contributions to candidates, independent expenditures, and the like that have been made. And then it's important to realize as well, there's this entire infrastructure that's been set up to support this movement, 501c3s, 501c4s, these tax-exempt organizations that provide training and resources and support to these rogue prosecutors and those who support them. And the money that supports those 501c3s, 501c4s, it can be a little bit hard to trace. But our best estimates are that all told, somewhere around $1 billion, billion with a B dollars, has been invested to support this movement. And of course, again, unfortunately, this movement has not helped the communities where these prosecutors have been elected. And we've seen violent crimes, robberies, rapes, murders, all of these horrible things increasing and largely going unpunished as a result of these DAs getting elected.
And they have been elected from coast to coast, from Los Angeles to New York City, from Chicago to St. Louis, and all across the country. These rogue prosecutors have been in office. However, some of them have come up for re-election. And as you pointed out, Zach, the fallout from their election, their failure to prosecute crime, has resulted in a rampant increase in crime. Some of them have lost their re-election bids, have they not?
They have. The good news is, once voters figured out, understood exactly what the role of the DA is, why the district attorney is such an important office, and how the policies, the non-prosecution policies these DAs were implementing, were affecting their day-to-day lives, voters responded appropriately. And so we saw, even in very liberal cities like San Francisco, the voters there recalled and removed from office Chase Abudin, who is the rogue prosecutor there. We saw George Gascon in Los Angeles lose his bid for re-election. We saw Mike Schmidt in Portland, Oregon lose his bid for re-election. Marilyn Mosby in Baltimore, she lost her bid for re-election, and she was subsequently indicted on federal fraud charges and is now a convicted federal felon. And then in other cities, we've seen rogue prosecutors resign in lieu of either potentially losing their bids for re-election or being removed from office. And so we saw Kim Gardner in St. Louis. She resigned from office in lieu of what was likely to be her removal due to a number of issues she was facing. And then Kim Fox in Chicago as well, she declined to run for another term after she had been roundly criticized for her handling of a number of matters.
Probably the most famous, or should we say infamous, of these rogue prosecutors, Alvin Bragg of New York City. He went after Donald Trump with what many believe to have been a made-up crime. How has he fared in New York City in terms of actual crime and cracking down on it, or the lack thereof?
Well, not well, Lohman. I think, if you look at Alvin Bragg, he issued what's known as a day one memo, where he essentially laid out entire categories of crimes that he would not prosecute, where he essentially said by default, sentences of non-incarceration, meaning he wouldn't ask for people to go to jail unless they committed a really heinous crime. And even in those instances where a really heinous crime was committed, he instructed his prosecutors to presumptively ask for no more than 25 years of imprisonment, even for people who may have committed very horrible crimes, again, like rape, robbery, or murder, something that I think most of us would consider to be too light of a sentence for justice to be done. And so, look, unfortunately, the citizens of Manhattan, they're under Alvin Bragg's tenure, are suffering. Alvin Bragg hasn't yet had to face the voters again since he first took office and implemented many of these problematic policies. But certainly, I think anyone who looks with a disinterested eye can say that the crime crisis in Manhattan today is largely due to Alvin Bragg's very problematic policies.
We have been talking with Zach Smith, who is Senior Legal Fellow and Manager of the Supreme Court and Appellate Advocacy Program at the Heritage Foundation. He has been talking about the book Rogue Prosecutors, How Radical Soros Lawyers Are Destroying America's Communities. He is co-author along with Charles D. Simpson. Zach, where can folks go to get a copy of Rogue Prosecutors? And also tell us a little bit about Heritage Foundation.
Sure. You can find the book at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or wherever else books are sold. You can follow me on X, formerly Twitter, at TZ Smith. And of course, the Heritage Foundation, we are a conservative think tank. I'm in the legal center, so I write and talk mostly about legal issues, the Supreme Court, crime, criminal justice, constitutional law issues. but my colleagues write on a number of issues. And so if you're interested in seeing all of the great things they work on, you can go to heritage.org and find more information there.
Zach Smith, author of Rogue Prosecutors. Zach, thank you for being with us.
Of course. Thanks for having me on the show.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth has been keeping an eye on developing races for U.S. Senate seats and congressional seats in the upcoming 2026 elections. Yeah, I know we just sort of got done with 2024, but we're on to the next cycle with Scott Parkinson. Scott, good to have you here.
It's a pleasure to be back, Loman. Thank you.
In the United States Senate, Scott, currently Republicans hold the majority 53-47. However, the playing field somewhat favors Democrats heading into next year as Republicans have more seats up than Democrats. What does that playing field look like at this stage?
Yeah, well, normally there are 33 seats that are up for re-election in every 2 years in the United States Senate, right? It's staggered so that you basically have an equal number of elections across 100 U.S. Senate races. And this time we have 22 Republican seats that are up, compared to just 13 for Democrats. Well, Loman, that doesn't equal 33, that equals 35. And the big reason is because Marco Rubio got poached from the United States Senate to be Secretary of State, and J.D. Vance got poached from the United States Senate to be Vice President of America, of the United States. And, you know, those, I think, are two seats that are not going to be a big challenge to retain. Ashley Moody was a former statewide elected official as Attorney General in Florida, and you know, she's going to, I think, coast to re-election. But it's still worth kind of keeping an eye on to see if the Democrats try to get a top-level recruit. And then you had the former Lieutenant Governor of Ohio, John Husted, that got appointed to the United States Senate to fill the vacancy left by J.D. Vance. Republicans are also starting to fight each other in some big, big primaries, where Republican incumbents are facing legit and credible campaign challenges from other MAGA-type candidates. And the biggest one that we're going to talk about today is down in the Lone Star State, where Attorney General Ken Paxton is primarying longtime U.S. Senator John Cornyn. Paxton has a reputation as being sort of a bulldog fighter, and Cornyn has been an intellectual leader of the Senate, done a lot of work on judicial nominations. He's a very senior member of the Senate Judiciary Committee. And there's been a lot of public polling that's been released this spring. And the first thing that I would point out about this race is that Ken Paxton is currently winning by double digits. Further complicated because there is a Republican congressman who's currently serving his second term, and he's also kicking the tires and deciding whether he's going to announce and make this a three-way race. That would be Wesley Hunt, and he's from the Houston area. Wesley Hunt getting in this race would almost certainly mean that it's headed to a runoff. And in a three-way race, Hunt still polls about 15% of the statewide vote. So in Texas, when you cannot reach 50%, you have an automatic runoff. You know, that would make this even more costly for national resources to be attributed to somebody like John Cornyn, and instead those resources would hopefully be used in competitive races where we can either win an open seat like Michigan or knock off a Dem incumbent that is vulnerable.
In addition to these races, in the state of North Carolina, that's become quite a battleground state in recent years. We have a Republican incumbent, but there could be a challenge there. How is that shaping up?
Yeah, Tom Tillis is the current Republican senator that's up for re-election in North Carolina. And the big question is whether North Carolina's governor, Roy Cooper, is going to run against Tillis. If he does, that will be Democrats' biggest recruit and a challenge for them to knock off a Republican senator. Tillis has won tight races in 2014 and 2020, and North Carolina is definitely a state that Democrats can be competitive in. So we need to watch that one really, really closely. I think that it could be the most expensive U.S. Senate race, not just in North Carolina history, but in U.S. history, given all the attention that it could receive. Tillis has also sort of run afoul with some of the conservatives in North Carolina because he has a little bit of an independent streak when it comes to support or opposition to some of Trump's policies and some of Trump's nominations that he's made. I'm watching that one really closely. I don't think that there's a credible primary challenge to Tom Tillis, but I do think in the general election, that's going to be one that probably comes down to the margin of error and is a 2 or 3% win either way.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth, keeping an eye on U.S. Senate races around the country shaping up for 2026. We'll continue to follow those throughout the summer and fall as they develop. Scott, tell us a little bit about the Club for Growth.
Club for Growth is based out of Washington, D.C., and we have a political action committee and a super PAC that get involved in these big federal races. Visit us at clubforgrowth.org, where you can actually sign up and become a member for free.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
Making America healthy again is a good goal, so long as the federal government does not devolve into being a nanny state. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine discusses the issue with Jeff Singer of the Cato Institute.
You know, for a long time, it seemed like the people who most want to control what you can eat, what you can buy at the store, they tend to be Democrats. They tend to be lefty progressives, like Michael Bloomberg in New York just naturally comes to mind, right? And his war on big gulps and oversized sodas that went on about a decade ago. But increasingly, these threats, this sort of nanny state tendency is emerging from the political right, too. And that's what we're going to get into with my guest today. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. That aforementioned guest is Dr. Jeffrey Singer. He's a senior fellow at the Cato Institute, and he's also a working surgeon, and he's taking some time, as I understand it, away from the operating room this afternoon to join us on the phone and to talk about a post that he wrote this week that you can find at Cato's blog about public health overreach in Texas specifically. Dr. Singer, thanks for joining us on the program here.
Quite welcome.
As you say in this blog post that people can find at cato.org, you're old enough to remember when people were protesting Michael Bloomberg's ban on sugary sodas. Heck, I mean, for that matter, I'm old enough to remember that. I wrote about it at the time in 2012. It was conservatives. It was the Tea Party era who were upset about these kind of nanny state impulses. And now you see some of those same impulses emerging on the political right as part of this this so-called MAHA movement.
Yeah, it's sort of everything is kind of in a state of flux as we're seeing a giant realignment take place in this country. So now people in of all places, Texas, are suddenly wanting to get the government involved in telling people what they can eat and dictating diet and exercise routines in the school system. And, you know, we should have learned by now, first of all, that when it comes to the government coming up with nutritional plans and those kind of things, it's vulnerable to all sorts of political and special interest influences, let alone the fact that when you're dealing with areas like nutrition, the science is so new, so relatively early and difficult to study. I mean, for example, we hear talk about all the different food additives, food colorings, et cetera, that may or may not be harmful. Right now, most of it is speculation because it's very difficult to do good randomized controlled trials on humans. So almost all the studies on this are either on animals or observational studies, which show correlations but not causation. And a lot of times they just lump in the terms ultra-processed foods without differentiating. I mean, there are numerous additives. Which particular ones are the problem? And at what dose? So all these things are unknown. And I'm not saying that it's not plausible, but we don't know enough. And what happens is when the government starts to make these blanket recommendations, before we know all the information, just based on sort of what intuitively kind of sounds like it makes sense, Well, that's going on vibes and not on evidence.
In effect, there's a distinction between the government's role in dealing with public health and the government's role when it comes to the choices that people are making about what they put in their bodies, right?
The legitimate role of government is in public health, in dealing with things like things that we as individuals can do that could unknowingly, unintentionally harm others, like dumping toxic products in the public square, polluting the air, maybe carrying a very highly contagious disease and we need to be isolated. Those are public health issues, but what we eat, how much exercise we get, what products we consume, these are personal health matters. And these are things that we should decide on our own as individuals in consultation with the experts we choose to consult. And once the government gets in with its recommendations, even, disclaimers notwithstanding, the tendency is that it becomes a de facto mandate, because when it has the imprimatur of a government agency saying this is what we think is the right thing to do, it becomes very difficult for people, including healthcare practitioners, to disagree for fear of being ridiculed or maybe losing their job if they're employed healthcare practitioners, or having difficulty defending themselves in lawsuits because they went against the government's recommendations. So it's in a free society, the government should focus on public health issues and leave personal health issues to us adults to discuss with our advisors.
We're talking with Dr. Jeff Singer. He's a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. Dr. Singer, you mentioned in your post here about this bill in Texas. You alluded to it in the response to that last question as well. Tell us a little bit about the specifics of that bill and how that's taking some of these principles that you're talking about here and steering them towards, actual government action.
Yeah, well, the Texas lawmakers overwhelmingly, in fact, unanimously in the Senate, passed a bill that is now, as we're recording this, is on the governor's desk, that would mandate that effective January 2027, all food products sold in the state of Texas have labels mentioning, as warning labels, mentioning whether they contain one of a list of 40 different additives, from food colorings to preservatives to flavor enhancers, none of which, by the way, has been definitely shown to cause any problems, some of which are suspected of causing problems. And if I could say another crucial point is, I can understand people being worried about whether these food additives are safe. That's a reasonable concern. But it's not as if they don't have choices right now. In fact, there's a huge market in organic foods. Virtually every supermarket has a section of the store where there's organic foods or foods that have labels on them saying no preservatives, no artificial coloring, no GMO, all this kind of stuff. In fact, there's a supermarket chain called Whole Foods. That's all they sell. So if you're concerned about it, it's not as if you don't have any options.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right, too. More choices give people more options in the market. The market does a great job of providing that anyway, but allow more choices, allow people to choose what they want. And then on the other side of that, of course, is don't prohibit some of those choices. That's unfortunately all the time we have for today. Dr. Jeff Singer, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And once again, that is Dr. Jeff Singer. He's a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. Check out his latest piece on Cato's blog. That's at cato.org. The headline on that piece is "From Nutrition to Nannying, Texas SB 25 and the New Public Health Overreach." Again, find that at cato.org. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Baim. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
The saying is, the only two sure things in life are death and taxes. So if tax they must, Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council offers 10 golden rules on this American Radio Journal commentary.
By any rational standard, a government should collect only the revenue it needs to fund core government services with the least amount of damage to the economy. The 10 golden rules of effective taxation from rich states, poor states are not revolutionary. They're common sense. But in politics, common sense can be anything but common. Rule number one, tax something more, you get less of it. You tax it less, you get more of it. That's not ideology, that's arithmetic. The notion that people will continue to work just as hard or invest just as much, regardless of how much is taken from them, ignores human behavior and reality. Rule number two, people work to improve the standard of living for themselves and their families, not for the privilege of paying taxes. If working harder means keeping less, many will choose to work less. It's a simple trade-off between effort and reward, but you wouldn't know that from the way that some legislators behave, as if taxation were a patriotic duty rather than a government imposition. Number three, taxes create a wedge between what a worker earns and what he takes home, and what that wedge grows, the economy contracts. What an employer pays is not what the employee receives. After federal, state, and payroll taxes, that paycheck may shrink by nearly half. Add in sales taxes and property taxes, and the incentives to work and hire begin to erode. And once again, that's not hypothetical. That's how it plays out in reality. Every time a business chooses not to expand or a worker decides overtime might not be worth it. Number four, raising tax rates doesn't guarantee raising revenue. In fact, it often does the opposite. As rates go up, people look for ways to shelter income, avoid taxable transactions, or simply opt out. The so-called Laffer curve is not about magic. It's about incentives. When people are penalized for being productive, fewer choose to be. And when tax rates fall, the economy grows and the base of taxable activity grows with it. Number five, there's a point at which tax rates become counterproductive. And that point is reached sooner than most politicians dare to admit. A 0% tax rate raises no revenue, but neither does a 100% tax rate, because no one works for the privilege of paying taxes. The real question is where the sweet spot lies. Too many states are way past it, and certainly we are in Washington, D.C., chasing revenue with higher rates, only to see economic activity vanish across state lines. Number six, the more mobile the capital, the more sensitive it is to taxes. In the 21st century, money moves at the speed of a mouse click. Taxing capital too heavily, and it will leave. That's not theory. It's happening. When California raises taxes on businesses, Nevada smiles. And when New York clamps down on investment income, Florida sends a thank you card. Number seven, tax one activity heavily, and you distort the others. When you raise a business tax, you get fewer jobs and less personal income taxes as well. Lower them, and the opposite happens. Rule number eight, broad base and a low rate will beat a narrow base and a high rate every time. High tax rates encourage loopholes, deductions, and evasion. And a low rate with a broad tax base reduces distortions and compliance costs, but it also treats everyone equally, something our current progressive tax system claims to do but doesn't. The tax code should be simple enough for ordinary citizens to understand, and not a full employment program for accountants and lobbyists. Number nine, transfer payments function as reverse taxes on work. The more generous the welfare benefits, the less there is an incentive to work. In high-benefit states, people can receive an equivalent of a $20 an hour job without working. That's not compassion, it's economic sabotage. And because welfare benefits are phased out as income rises, they impose punishing effective tax rates on the poor and discourage upward mobility in the exact very work that is needed to escape poverty. And finally, rule number 10, people and businesses can move, and they do. If state A raises taxes and state B cuts them, you don't need an advanced economics degree to predict what happens next. Factories relocate, families move, and taxpayers vote with their feet. If politicians want economic growth and job creation and long-term prosperity, they would do well to learn by these 10 golden rules of taxation, or at the very least, stop acting as if incentives don't matter when it comes to policy, because they do. For more information, you can go to alec.org. For American Radio Journal, I'm Jonathan Williams. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KRBL-FM in Lubbock, Texas, KCEA-FM in Redwood City, California, along with WEJZ-FM in Jacksonville, Florida. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.